We are back with the Tech Policy Grind. I'm Victoria Ferrari, a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry 7th Cohort, the organization where the next generation of tech law and policy professionals convene to write, think, and talk about the web, technology, and disruptive innovation. This is Tech Policy Grind, the Foundry's podcast where we chat about what's going on in the world of tech policy. Today, I will be discussing cross-border data transfers with Amanda Molina. Amanda, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Victoria. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Amanda Molina. I'm an attorney. My official title is Associate General Counsel of Artificial Intelligence and Privacy at Booz Allen Hamilton, as well as a Judge Advocate General for the United States Air Force Reserve Corps.
So excited to have you on. I wanted to really start this discussion by defining this topic and setting some shared language for our audience. So at a very high level, when we're talking about cross-border data transfers, what are we actually referring to and why has this become such a major issue right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I begin, I do want to say that all of these views are explicitly my own and do not reflect Booz Allen Hamilton, the United States government, or any government agency, including the military.
Thank you.
I have to make sure I disclaim.
Absolutely.
So I love this question. Every time you use a cloud application, stream content, or receive a targeted advertisement, your data is crossing borders, often multiple borders, invisibly, in milliseconds. The phrase cross-border data transfer sounds technical, but at its core, it's actually who gets to see your information, under what laws, and with what protections. It's not an legally abstract question. It's a question about power over your life. Before we can talk about law, we have to talk about something a little bit more fundamental, is different parts of the world have genuinely different understandings of what privacy is, why it matters, and who it protects. Those who are not the policy background might understand this nuance. But essentially, different parts of the world have different geopolitical as well as civilizational differences, rooted in centuries of distinct philosophical and historical and political experience. France, for example, and continental Europe ground their privacy and human dignity. The trauma of World War II and Nazi occupation, which meticulously recorded census data, religious registries, neighborhood surveillance, was used to systematically and specifically target certain populations, especially Jewish populations. And that entire regime, their legal regime, descends, like the GDPR, for example, the General Data Protection Regulation, from that historical significance. It's more of a human rights instrument in that sense. The United States, if I'm going a little bit too in-depth, let me know.
You are absolutely not. You are flowing us through right the next questions of, like, why is it so fragmented? So I appreciate it and keep going.
The United States' conception of privacy is fundamentally different. It's rooted in liberty. So specifically, freedom from government intrusion. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizure. Privacy in the American tradition is a shield against state power, not the broader human dignity sense that I just discussed, or private actors. And this is why the U.S. has never passed a comprehensive privacy law, because the commercial internet was built on an implicit social contract that give us your data and you will receive free services. I can go a little bit into China if you'd like as well.
Absolutely. What are some of the distinctions that makes these global laws so fragmented and why we haven't had this like unified structure? China would be a great example for our audience.
All right. China's really interesting. So China's approach is explicitly collective. Data is understood as a national resource and a strategic asset. Individual privacy exists in Chinese law, and there's their personal information protection law, which is called the PIPL, and it's fundamentally subordinate to state access and social stability. And then there's a fourth tradition that I just believe gets far less attention, but it is gaining force, and it's a post-colonial data sovereignty movement emerging from Africa, Latin America, Asia, and Southeast Asian regions. These are countries whose citizens' data has been extracted for decades by foreign platforms used to build enormously valuable AI systems and monetized in ways that generated essentially no benefit for the communities whose data made their possible. One more thing I want to contextualize, because I've heard this a lot, and I think it goes directly to the core of your question, but most people assume that AI systems have essentially read and processed the entire internet. That essentially all of the world's data, and I've heard this from many different people, all of the world's data are in these AI systems, and it can be far from the truth. I have a few quick stats for you. The reality is far more constrained, and the implications matter deeply. The world generates and stores approximately 120 to 150 zettabytes of data. The largest AI large language models are trained on roughly 15 trillion tokens of data. What does this translate to, right? Right? It means that even at the high end, only a fraction of the percent of the world's total data store is actually in these models at the moment, a very small fraction. And in fact, even though 86 to 93% of the training data is of English language source, despite the fact that English is the primary language for only 18% of the world's population, the world's 7,100 language and the rest of the world's knowledge and cultural traditions and populations, legal concepts are not necessarily embedded. So at the core of this question is not necessarily, you know, how can we get all the information into the AI system? It's more about whose knowledge, whose values, and whose civilization's traditions are being encoded into these systems and whose are being erased.
Absolutely. That brings up the term that we have been reading about quite a bit lately, this digital nationalism of this question of like where data sovereignty belongs rather to the state or to the individual. Can you help us frame that big picture and sort of go into some of the geopolitical states of, do you think we're headed towards a world of digital nationalism?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're already there in significant parts of the world. The question of whether democratic societies mount a coherent alternative before the trajectory becomes irreversible is a question that's already being asked. China's model, for example, is explicit. Data flows serve state interests. The architecture to enforce that is operational. Russia's sovereign internet law creates basically a kill switch for global connectivity within its borders. Iran and North Korea have also built similar architectures. And these aren't hypothetical futures. They're operational realities that exist today and are increasingly becoming exported to other countries through the Digital Silk Road and similar initiatives. Mistral, for example, is one of the few large language models that are coming out of France. I wouldn't equate them to the ones I just mentioned, but it is worth noting that that comes out of that idea that sovereignties want to have power and control over their own large language models and govern their information. The more difficult question for democratic audiences is whether digital nationalism is also creeping into democratic systems itself, not just through explicit authoritarian design, but through the accumulated weight of national security exemptions, for example, emergency surveillance authorities, platform regulation that functionally requires data mobilization, and trade policy that treats data as a strategic commodity rather than a fundamental rights issue. Each individual measure can be defensible, but what I see is that when you take all of these exceptions and you put them into a cumulative pattern, it can erode individual rights without ever explicitly repealing them.
Absolutely. Do you think, in terms of a future direction and thinking about global equity, should these emerging economies develop their own data governance models, or should they gravitate towards something like how the EU or China approaches or pursue something completely different?
Absolutely. I think this is a great question because it's where the abstract philosophical debates about privacy and sovereignty meet the concrete question of what I just mentioned about who benefits from the digital economy and who gets left behind. The conventional policy answer is aligned with the GDPR. The General Data Protection Regulation, because it's the de facto global standard It has real protections, and regulatory harmonization reduces compliance costs for companies operating across borders. There's genuine merit to that argument, but it assumes that GDPR was designed with the global South circumstances in mind, and it wasn't. Allow me to elaborate. So GDPR was designed for high income, high institutional capacity democracies with functioning data protection authorities, independent jurisdictions, legal aid infrastructure, populations with high literacy and ability to exercise their rights and resources. Applying that framework in context where those institutional prerequisites doesn't produce equivalent protections is compliance theater from my perspective. The statistical reality of where AI training data comes from makes that equity argument pretty undeniable. As I just mentioned, the world's data, including behavioral data, health data, linguistic data, and cultural production of billions of people from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, has powered AI systems now generating trillions of dollars in economic value. And those communities who made this possible haven't received that much value directly from those systems. They do receive some of the products, often late or in constrained forms, but the wealth created by these AI systems, the equity valuations, enterprise contracts, productivity gains, is overwhelmingly in the countries and by the companies and shareholders in just a select few places. So, more directly to your question, what I would advocate for, both as a matter of sound policy design and political strategy for emerging economies, is a modular coalition-based approach. So borrow the GDPR's core principles, which is purpose limitation, data minimization, meaningful consent, and accountability, because those principles are genuinely sound and applying them creates interoperability within the EU's adequacy framework, but build enforcement mechanisms that fit your institutional context. So add data benefit sharing provisions that require mechanisms such as companies basically paying for meaningful economic return to that population. Require capacity building provisions so foreign data processors invest in local data protection authority capability, not just local server infrastructure. And do this in regional coalitions rather than in isolation, because the negotiating leverage of Asia, Africa, South Asia, and Latin America together is vastly greater than any singular entity or country acting alone. What I'm watching closely, just as an example, by the way, is the African Union's data policy framework, which explicitly invokes as a common denominator and resource African people and advocates for a pan-African approach that doesn't copy the European model, but it doesn't accept the Chinese model either. Brazil has also established its own enforcement independence that a lot of observers are watching from middle-income countries as well. The right aspiration across all these contexts is what I would call principled sovereignty, which is genuine control over your population's data, exercised through frameworks that reflect your own values rather than borrowed frameworks that are applied without adaptation and pursued in coalition rather than singularly. So it's about who you share your structural position with and to further your own country's goals in the global digital economy.
Absolutely. And thank you for those examples. I think that's going to help folks bridge that policy. And I heard you mentioning a little bit about the real world consequences of these policies. How do you think this patchwork of global data laws impact companies operating across borders?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting question. Large multinational companies with dedicated legal and compliance teams navigating the global legal patchwork is extraordinarily expensive, but it's manageable. You build compliance programs, negotiate data processing agreements, conduct transfer impact assessments, and maintain specific privacy notices. These are just examples of things that they'll typically do. The largest tech companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars annually on privacy compliance. But like I mentioned, it's manageable and in some ways advantageous because the compliance cost functions as a market barrier to other smaller competitors. Speaking of which, the real victims of fragmentation are mid-sized and small companies who want to cooperate globally but can't afford a team of data lawyers like myself in every single jurisdiction. A software company in Nairobi, or a fintech in Jakarta, or a health tech company in Bogota that wants to serve customers in Europe or India or the United States face a compliance matrix that would cost millions to address properly. The GDPR alone requires DPA officers for certain processing activities, comprehensive privacy notices. So you can see these layered jurisdictional requirements can be very difficult for these smaller and mid-sized companies to navigate. And oftentimes, the companies that lose most in this environment are often the most innovative and most likely to build solutions that serve underserved populations. There's a profound product design consequence because of this that receives insufficient attention in policy discussions. When you're building a product that must simultaneously comply with all of these laws, including China's, India's, especially if you want to have a global company, the most restrictive approach, such as, like I mentioned, applying the highest global standard, may make your product uncompetitive in markets where local competitors face no equivalent constraints. So oftentimes we will try to build to that, but it makes it difficult as you try to adjust your product. So product developers often lack, not lack, but face this issue of, do we build a product that is jurisdiction specific? So it's fragmented to my engineers that will then allow for multiple attack vectors from a cybersecurity perspective and also creates organizational complexities depending on where your customers are located. Or do we build one particular product? One solution that I'm seeing that is relatively new is something called edge computing and on-device AI, which offers one structural path to address this problem. Essentially, if processing happens locally and the data never crosses the border, many cross-border data transfer obligations simply don't arise. So I'm watching this with cautious optimism. And this other trend that I'm seeing is something called privacy as a competitive differentiator. So companies like Microsoft, for example, are able to differentiate themselves through their privacy designs and maximize a built-in architecture rather than just kind of tacking it on at the end and saying, okay, we meet all of these checkboxes. It's a lot usually to build up front, especially for coders and developers who are building these things from the ground up.
It's very interesting. So the term actually data localization has come up a lot in a lot of these frameworks. What does that actually mean in practice, and how do these countries, like we've mentioned, China or India, enforce it?
So what is data localization? It's almost self-evident, but at its basic form, it's essentially the data generated in a country, stored and processed, is physically located in the country's borders. So China, Russia, Indonesia, India, for specific categories, Nigeria as well, are a growing number of countries that have adopted some version of this kind of requirement of localization. The political logic is multiple strands. National security agencies want assured jurisdiction over data relevant to their citizens. Domestic technology industries want to compete on even terms with foreign platforms that don't bear local infrastructure costs. And post-colonial governments want to ensure that data generated by their population is not simply exported for foreign benefit with nothing returned. China, I think, is an example of this. So its enforcement model is the world's most developed and instructive. Under their data security law, PFPL, which I already mentioned, outbound transfers of important data require security assessment by the Cyberspace Administration of China. So critical information operators must store data domestically and strict conditions on any cross-border data transfers. This is operationally real. So just to give you an example, Apple moved their iCloud data for Chinese servers or users to servers operated by state-owned enterprises, a decision that it drew a lot of criticism from privacy advocates because of the implications for Chinese government access. Another example of this is a ride-hailing company, I believe it's pronounced Didi, but they faced major regulatory action in 2021, partly over data governance concerns following its New York IPO. TikTok, for example, ByteDance invested billions in establishing domestic data infrastructure in the U.S. and Europe under the reasoning that it wanted to respond to a lot of national security concerns about Chinese data access. India is another example, and you specifically asked, like, as an example for these ones. So India's approach under the Digital Protection Act is more graduated and still being implemented, but they have something called critical personal data. So it's a category that's not yet fully defined in implementing regulations, but it essentially requires localization within India. They also have what's commonly known as sensitive personal data may be transferred to countries that India designates as trusted. General personal data can flow more freely in this way. The challenges for many countries implementing the localization regimes is that meaningful enforcement requires institutional capacity, as I mentioned earlier. It takes years to build that. A functioning data protection board, technical audit capabilities, cross-border legal assistance, mechanisms, and trained personnel. The risk is that formal localization requirements exist on paper, while actual compliance is widely uneven because the enforcement infrastructure is not yet operational.
Absolutely. And we briefly touched on the global data laws impacting companies and the borders. And you gave us some really great examples. And I wanted to hear more about what responsibility do corporations have to be transparent about where and how user data moves globally?
So this is an interesting question about what responsibility corporations have. From a specific, I'll say, social perspective, or if you want to look at it from like a free market perspective, there is some social corporate social responsibility to some degree, especially with respect to ensuring that long-term trust in the products that you build. From a legal perspective, in most jurisdictions, corporations have essentially no meaningful transparency obligation about where data goes and how it's collected. Privacy policies technically disclose data sharing practices, but they're basically unreadable. And I say that in the sense of, for example, that the average privacy policy is around 8,000 words. I've read a lot of research in this space because I have to read these so often. but one researcher, her name's Lori Craner, she and different colleagues in the space have basically produced information that says it requires about 76 full working days if you were going to read all of the major privacy policies. No one actually does this, and companies kind of know that. So it's essentially a feature that they're well aware of, that people aren't reading through these massive documents. So the modern privacy policy's function is not to inform users, it's to provide legal cover for data practices that users would likely reject if they truly understood them. So what meaningful transparency actually looks like is worth describing concretely, because more transparency is a phrase that can mean nearly nothing in that context, or almost nothing in that context. It means real-time, machine-readable disclosure of where data is stored, who has access to it, or what legal framework for what purposes. Similar to how financial products are required to disclose fees, risks, and their purpose, or counterparts, there's like comparable formats, it means disclosure at the point of interaction, not buried in documents that are once signed at account creation. It means layered disclosure, so a plain summary available at first interaction, technical details available for those who request it. It means the practical ability to withdraw consent without losing access to the services you depend on, because consent's not really meaningful if the only alternative is opting out of the digital economy entirely. It's worth noting here that most of the legal regimes that were created around the dot-com and internet bubble, the 1990s and early 2000s. Today, the law is trying to catch up to where the technology is at, but they really didn't contemplate the type of mass data collection that is happening at this level. And you add the AI dimension to that, and it complicates it even further. So the AI dimension makes corporate transparency obligations dramatically more urgent. Essentially, when you interact with AI systems, you're contributing to training data that shapes future model behavior. And I have looked at nearly every single user for all the large language models, terms and conditions, user terms and conditions. If you are utilizing a free model or a free account for any single one of these, you are oftentimes, I would say 90% of the time at least, this is my own personal opinion, you are oftentimes giving them full rights to train their model on your data. And that is explicit in those contracts. So you may be generating outputs that are stored, analyzed, used in ways that you are not aware of, and that even the system operators didn't fully anticipate, because AI is constantly evolving, and it's evolving in a way that even those who are designing it don't necessarily even anticipate all the time. So it's not just evolving, but now it's being accessed in different contexts, and it's drawing inferences that you never consented to. So the thing that you are consenting to may not be fully knowledgeable at the time of consent, not because of bad faith on the part of the developers, but because this space is constantly evolving and behaviors are emerging that developers don't fully understand.
Thank you for mentioning the incident reporting and disclosure requirements, because I think a lot of standards are being talked about, but there aren't. I think a example, like flexible example, would be helpful for folks. So how should companies navigate conflicting incident reporting and disclosure requirements when a cross-border data breach occurs?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the hardest operational problems in data law today, and it grows harder every year as more jurisdictions enact mandatory breach notification laws with different timelines, different trigger thresholds, different notification recipients, and different content requirements. As I've already mentioned several times under GDPR, as typically the one that a lot of people look to as the standard, the GDPR is a 72-hour notification requirement to supervisory data protection authorities after becoming aware of a breach for, under specific cases, a clock that starts running before you often understand even the scope of the incident or have confirmed its cause. China's PIPL has different timelines and different severity categories. U.S. SEC has cybersecurity disclosure requirements and rules for material breach disclosures within 4 days of determining materiality. So I'm not going to go into all the technical and legal details here, but the point is that every single jurisdiction is a little bit different. And again, having to navigate that space is really difficult. So none of these frameworks are designed to work together. They frequently produce genuinely contradictory obligations. I have to mention that most of the time I'm sitting here in generalities, there's of course nuances to the law. So what's my practical guidance? Is treat incident response planning as a legal and governance priority, not primarily a technical one. And treat it before you have an incident rather than during one. I promise you, if you wait till during the incident, it is a lot more complicated. Map your data flows. Identify which jurisdiction laws apply to which categories of data. Pre-draft notification templates for each applicable regime. Establish privacy protocols so that legal analysis conducted during the breach response is properly protected. And identify your single points of contact in each jurisdiction. When you are 36 hours into an active breach, simultaneous coordination, managing technical remediation, executive communication, law enforcement coordination, media inquiries, you won't have the bandwidth, as I just noted, to conduct like a full principled analysis of every single law and its obligations. You're going to need to respond very quickly, and you're going to need to do it in a way that is legally sufficient. So the best thing to do is just to get that stuff done up front. The deep structural problem is that breach notification regimes are fundamentally domestic legal instruments applied to apparently transnational events. So as we've discussed nearly this entire time, data is not specific to a region most of the time. And while localization is becoming more prominent, we've discussed that nationalization piece, transnational is in connectivity and cross-border data transfers is a modern concept and issue to some degree. So a breach affecting users in 40 countries triggers notification obligations in some of those countries with conflicting timelines, notifications, authorities in each country potentially demanding different and sometimes legally privileged or confidential information with no coordination among those authorities. The analogy that I find most clarifying is international aviation accident investigations, for example. Before the International Civil Aviation Authority established clear protocols around 1944, aviation incidents were investigated under incompatible national frameworks, and the resulting duplication and inconsistency impeded safety improvements and national efforts and frameworks from actually coming to fruition. We're at a similar inflection point with data breaches. An international agreement establishes harmonized notification timelines, single point of contact mechanism, and information sharing frameworks that don't require breach victims to simultaneously comply with conflicting disclosure obligations across dozens of jurisdictions to achieve the necessities and the urgency of the issue at hand. I'll note one more gap that I've seen, which is the breach notification frameworks that also were designed for failure modes that didn't necessarily contemplate AI since creation. So traditional data frameworks assume unauthorized access to stored data, typically a defined category of information that was collected and is now in the wrong hands. So simple definition, easy from a legal perspective. AI, it's not the same. AI systems fail in ways that traditional frameworks can't easily capture. So training data leaks, fine-grained inference exposure, adversarial prompt injection enabling extraction of sensitive information, model inversion attacks that reconstruct data training from model outputs. So none of these have clear notification triggers under existing law. We're trying to apply frameworks that are designed for stolen credit card numbers to categories of harm that are structurally different. And we need to close that gap before the next generation of AI, specific security incidents creates legal chaos that existing frameworks simply can't solve.
Absolutely. I would love to, since a lot of our questions, you've come with some great like philosophical reasoning examples to gauge sort of your vision and synthesis for a redesign of the system. So if you could redesign the global data system from scratch, what would a fair and functional cross-border data framework look like?
This is definitely my personal opinion on this. So I did want to clarify that. So, to directly answer your question, if I could redesign the global data system from scratch, what would a fair, functional cross-border data framework look like? I would start from a principle. As I noted earlier, companies have different objectives, people have different objectives, entities have different objectives. So, this principle that I would start with is not currently exist in binding international instrument, but it's that data rights follow the person, not the server. So wherever your data goes, your country's laws govern the server, whatever company's terms of service you agree to, your fundamental rights as the data subject travel with it. This is the digital equivalent of the principle that human rights are universal and portable. They don't disappear when you cross a border, and they should not disappear when your country crosses the border. Secondly, I would build interoperability rather than uniformity. So what does this actually look like, right? The world can't and shouldn't agree on a single global privacy law because of that pluralism that I've already discussed. So the value of pluralism is real and legitimate, and a single global standard would rather be too weak to protect anyone or so demanding that it disrupts legitimate state interests and security, governance, and democratic self-determination. So what would be achievable here is something that would allow for mutual recognition and I think cooperation. And analogous to how professional licenses are recognized across jurisdictions or how safety standards for commercial aviation are accepted globally. So what I'm talking about here is a framework under which meeting your home jurisdiction's established privacy standard is presumptively acceptable for transfers to other mutually recognized jurisdictions. This would reduce compliance costs dramatically for companies, preserve policy space for different regulatory approaches, and maintain the interoperability that global commerce and communication require. And then finally, equity has to be at the architectural base of this idea. It should be embedded, not rhetorically, but something that can be apprehended. I'm sorry, offended. Let me just repeat that because it's important. So finally, equity has to be embedded architecturally, and it shouldn't just be something rhetorical. The historical asymmetry in who has benefited from the global economies, peripheral just corporate social responsibility programs, it's a structural feature that any legitimate governance has to address. That means mandatory data sharing provisions for AI training data derived from populations in developing nations. It means capacity building requirements embedded in data processing agreements with foreign companies, not just voluntary commitments. It means meaningful governance participation rights, decision-making authority in international standard bodies and treaty processes, not observing status after the rules have been set. And it means recognition that the communities whose data powered the AI economy have legitimate claims on the value for that data that they helped create. Finally, this is where the most exciting near-term innovation is happening. So technical enforcement has to be central to the architecture, not just an afterthought in a legal instrument. As you mentioned, I am an attorney and I operate, at the executive level with respect to AI governance, but legal rights without enforcement mechanisms are just aspirational. What we need are privacy-preserving technologies built into the infrastructure itself. So federal learning allows AI models to improve without centralizing raw data, differential privacy techniques that add calibrated mathematical noise so individual records cannot be re-identified from aggregate outputs, homomorphic encryption enabling computation on encrypted data without ever decrypting it. I know I'm very much in the weeds on this, but I've thought deeply on these things I think really matter. And then finally, on-device AI that runs inference locally without transmitting query data to any of those servers. So, such for example, like Apple's on-device AI, Meta's local-deployed llama model and advanced and efficient small models designed for edge hardware represented technical trajectories that I think could actually achieve all the things I'm talking about and shift data governance from a compliance problem more so to an architecture problem. So taking those things into consideration, I think that's likely where we will continue to be headed. But unless we address that architectural problem now and consider that pluralistic aspect.
Amanda, that was fantastic. Your vision is something truly looking forward to. I enjoyed our conversation here today. Thank you for joining us on a podcast. Before we wrap up, is there anything that you'd recommend our listeners read or listen to if they're interested more in the topic that we discussed here today?
Books that come directly to mind. They're not specifically AI books, but the first one is Kai-Fu Lee. So he has AI 2041. It's essentially an anthology to some degree, but it takes different stories and it's easy read, but it gives you an idea of where AI is going by 2041. So that's Kai-Fu Lee. I also really like Annie Jacobson. She has a book called The DARPA Brain. That one I read a couple of years ago. I think it's fantastic. It's more so the history of technology in the United States and the connection between DARPA and the technology community. So understanding how it's progressed throughout the years is a better understanding of not just of the legal regimes that exist, but also how societies have actually entwined between those three entities, the state, the market, and the user. How those three individuals have actually built these technological concepts. And finally, I'm going to have to recommend myself. I'm in this organization called the American Society for AI. We have an anthology that is being published very soon, but the digital version is already available. My chapter is on transparency, specifically in AI systems. And I talk about how transparency shouldn't be a theater where companies publish model cards, talk about responsible AI principles without actually giving transparency into how they operate. But it means explainability in the inference level so that users understand why a decision was made about them, and data transparency at the pipeline level where it's traceable, auditable, and people understand what rights are secured and how they're used. So I think that it's achievable, that particular standard, and that's what I talk about in the chapter with my co-author.
Amazing. Thank you, Amanda. And thank you for joining us on this call today. I think this was a extremely informative podcast episode, and please check out all the literature that Amanda just mentioned. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Tech Policy Grind, and make sure to follow and check out Amanda and The Foundry on LinkedIn. We appreciate your time. Obrigado.